Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Okay, Bob, this is John Williams, and I'm really intrigued by that story about the secondary market for the Obama speech tickets.
Yeah, 2,500 according to DNA Info.
And they said it's one person per ticket or one ticket per person, yeah. And they're not for sale or resale. So you're not supposed to do that. I think we all kind of run into this conversation when it's a concert ticket or a football game or something like that, and some people want to go. And I always sort of understand that dynamic. I think it's really, this is a very good example of that, isn't it? If you really want to go, but you weren't there at 3 in the morning in the cold, and you've got $1,500 and it's worth $1,500 to you, I'm not sure I mind somebody standing in line getting the ticket and selling it to you. Do you have a strong opinion about this either way, Bob?
I think it goes against the spirit of it, right? In a way, but
what
they
is
are
the
going
spirit
for,
of it? What is
the spirit of it? Is it's a free event, and if you go, I don't know. Yeah,
I guess it's a free. That's the spirit it violates.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't violate the spirit of if you're really an Obama fan, then be there. Some people just couldn't be there, or chose not to be because they have money and somebody else is willing to trade for that. I guess the point is the people that will be in the audience really want to be in the audience, and some of them will have had time and some of them will have money, and I'm not sure that that should be such a problem for people. But I'm open to discussion about that, and we'll get to that in a little bit. We're going to start, though, with a little movie news. Hidden Figures. Have you seen this movie or heard much about it? Won the Friday box office as it expanded nationwide, earning a strong, I'm reading now from HollywoodReporter.com, a strong $7.6 million from 2,400 theaters and nabbing a coveted A-plus cinema score. The movie with a bunch of stars, Kevin Costner and Octavia Spencer, of course, she's been nominated for a Golden Globe on this one, is about mathematicians who helped NASA put a man into space. It's tipped to earn $21 million for the weekend. That's ahead of expectations, they say. Coming in ahead of expectations, Hidden Figures is expanding this weekend. After opening in just 25 locations on Christmas Day, it only cost $25 million to make this movie, and it's won several award nominations, again, including a Golden Globe's Best Supporting Actress for Octavia Spencer. And I just before the show talked to the co-author of a book about this, and it's just fascinating. The book is titled Hidden Human Computers, The Black Women of NASA. So it tells the same story. And the woman that we talked to is named Duchess Harris. Her grandmother was Miriam Daniel Mann, one of the first class of these brilliant 11 women. They used like slide rules and pencils to do a bunch of mathematical calculations to help NASA and help get John Glenn into space. So talk about hidden figures. Black women who were actually doing some of the science and engineering, some of the math for the early NASA program. We'll start our conversation with the movie trailer.
We all gonna end up unemployed riding around in this pile of junk.
You're welcome to walk the 16 miles.
Or I'll sit in the back of the bus.
You have identification on it?
NASA, sir.
NASA? I had no idea they hired it.
There are quite a few women working in the space program.
Least I can do is give y'all an escort.
Three Negro women are chasing a white police officer down the highway in 1961. That is a God-ordained miracle.
Is that story true?
I'm not sure if that story is true about being on the highway and breaking down.
And a white cop coming up and then saying, wow, and then escorting them into town or into NASA or wherever.
Right. That feels like a nice opening for a Hollywood film. And I actually saw the film last night. And much of the depiction, I think, was accurate, but there was definitely some creative license.
Let's go back to the trailer already in progress.
In 14 days, astronauts will be here for training, and we're shooting a human into space, and it's never been done before.
With the launch of the Russian spy satellite, the president is demanding an immediate response.
Running from the man.
space test group needs a computer.
Catherine's the gal for that. She can handle any numbers you put in front of her. You and I are
different from each other. This is about inventing the math, because without it, we're not going anywhere.
Yes, sir.
That's John Glenn.
What do you guys do for NASA?
Calculate your launch and landing, sir.
By the way, there's a scene in your book where you say that John Glenn specifically wanted one of these black women human computers to make sure that his trajectory and his math was correct on the mission. Is that part of the story true?
That is absolutely true. That is Katherine Johnson. She's the only original computer that's still alive. She's 98 years old, and she lives in Hampton, Virginia. And that is accurate.
How about that? So I guess you've known. So the world is now just coming to hear this story through things like your book, mm-hmm. the attendant articles, and certainly this feature movie with Kevin Costner, et cetera. But you've known this story all along.
Well, I've known this story all along because I was actually named after one of the human computers.
That would be Duchess whom?
That actually, my legal name is Miriam, and that would be Miriam Daniel Mann, who was my grandmother, who was born in 1907. And the Hollywood version of the story takes place in 61 and 62, but the true arc of this goes back to World War II. And so my grandmother started working at NASA in 1943. She was in the first group of 11 black women that worked there.
It wasn't called NASA at the time.
It was called NACA.
NACA.
Yes.
And why was it that they allowed these women to do that work?
Because we'd gone into war and NASA had only had white men working there and they went off to war. So then they went and found white women and there weren't enough.
And what was the work they did?
They were doing calculations that actually started on a slide rule. And it was the early beginnings of the space race. This is a decade before Sputnik.
How did these women get that education?
They got that through the historically black college that was called Hampton Institute at the time, which is now Hampton University. And so my grandfather was a professor at Hampton. My grandmother, even though she was born in 1907, actually had a chemistry degree from Talladega College. So when they went to Hampton to do the recruiting, they said, are there any colored girls that are capable of doing this work? Some of them took the test. 11 of them passed, and that's the beginning of this narrative.
It's sad that it took that measure of desperation to realize all of the human capital that we're leaving on the table.
And it was even more than a level of desperation. It was actually illegal. So what a lot of people don't know is that the state of Virginia was still federally segregated because this is 43, and you don't get desegregation until 1954. And so one of the reasons why they're called hidden is because it had to be kept secret that they were working there.
Well, you said in the book sometimes they would hire these people not mm-hmm. knowing what was going to walk through the door. And lo and behold, it's a black woman. I mean, wasn't
right.
there at least one scene where they went, oh, we didn't realize we'd hired you?
Exactly. And then also there are skin tone politics, like the color of the women. And so these women came from the black elite, the privileged class. And so a lot of them were lighter skinned. And so my grandmother's best friend was a woman named Catherine Pedrew. When they hired her, they sent her to go work with the white women. And when she saw all the women there were white, she looked at them and said, do you realize I'm colored? And they said, now we do. And so then they sent her to an entirely different part.
So when they were doing work for NACA or NASA, mm-hmm. they would segregate them by race?
They had to, because it was against the law for a federal entity to be integrated. And so that's the legal part of this that people have a really difficult time struggling with, that I found the deed to the land. NASA was Chesterville Plantation until 1950.
NASA was Chesterville Plantation. What does that
mean? Until 1950.
What does that mean, plantation?
That it originally had been a plantation where people had worked the crops there. Then the land had been transferred over to the government, but they hadn't changed all of the title.
If the women or if the people of color were such second-class citizens, then why did they trust them to do these all-important calculations?
Well, they didn't trust them until they started seeing the work. So actually, the first year my grandmother worked there, she worked in a building that didn't even have a bathroom. And so it's not like they were treated with high regard.
Did they have to, in fact, rise to a standard higher than maybe the whites or the white men?
I mean, 100%, partly because they knew that they could just have a bad day and get fired on the spot.
Were they calculators, that is, plug the numbers into a formula, and once you understand that, however difficult, that's kind of routine, or were they doing original mathematics? Were they actually solving
both.
Problems?
They were doing both. They were actually doing original math as well.
There's a scene in the movie, and again, I think it's told in your book. Pardon me, I'm going back and forth in my brain now, but where they would never let a black woman in on these meetings where they would discuss the engineering problems.
Right.
And then one of the women said, I'm going into that meeting. Can you tell that story?
Sure. So the movie focuses around Katherine Johnson, partly because she is still alive. And so the screenplay was based on a book where someone was actually able to interview her. The issue was that women weren't allowed to be engineers. That's why they were computers.
And they weren't in the meetings.
So that's why they weren't in the meetings. But they were actually doing the work of engineers.
One of the guys says to her, if you were a white man, what would you want to be? Would you want to be an engineer? And she said, if I was a white man, I already would be.
Of course.
I'm doing the work.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was probably a delicate dance for your grandmother or this woman to be too forthright with the information. Maybe they would see that as too strident for somebody who, in their estimation, was a lower class.
Well, they had double jeopardy because the white women didn't have an easy time at NASA because they weren't really welcomed either. They were last resort as well. So the fact that they were both black and women was a problem. One of the most exciting stories that we have in my family is that my mother distinctly remembers the day that my grandmother met John Glenn. And so my grandmother was a part of all of that. She was actually at NASA for 23 years. She was there from 1943 to 1966. So she saw everything but the moon landing. She took ill and passed away in 67. Huh. So I was born in 69, which, of course, was the year that we got to the moon, which is partly why I was named after her.
Huh. Too bad she wasn't alive to see that.
Yeah. But our family's extremely proud.
Feeling that the moon launch is part of your DNA, isn't
it? Oh, big time. Yeah.
Well, then why aren't you a professor of mathematics and physics?
You know, someone has to write about math.
You're getting tired of that question, aren't you?
Right? You know?
I also just think it's remarkable because any of us who've ever studied math appreciate that it's difficult to do, but a good teacher can teach it to you and you can learn it. But few of us have the cultural roadblocks. It's hard enough to just understand this stuff, let alone having people look over their shoulder every time you want to achieve.
Right. I mean, one of the things I appreciate about the movie is that it tells the story of Mary Jackson, who has to get a court order to be able to go to a white high school, to evening class, to get the extra learning, to try to become an engineer. What's great about that is that it's 1961. And people see that just because Brown versus Board of Education happened doesn't mean it was implemented 7 years later.
Yeah, I know.
One of my issues with the movie, however, is that you don't see the black colleges in the role that the black colleges played, which was all throughout the South because there's several NASA campuses and most of them are in segregated spaces. And so the one in Houston, Texas is geographically located near four black colleges, and that's where they got their talent.
Computers is literally what they were. They were computers before there were computers. You insert the word human.
Right.
Because we need to understand the distinction today. But originally, computers were humans who did computing. Hence the title, Hidden Human Computers, the Black Women of NASA. Well done, Duchess. It's nice to meet you. And congratulations to your late grandmother and your family.
Thank you so much.
That's Professor Duchess Harris. She is a professor at McAllister College in Minnesota. She's a professor of American Studies and the chairman of that department. She's just a delight. I mentioned she's in Minnesota. The Minnesota Vikings, having heard about this book, bought 300 copies of it for distribution throughout schools in the Twin Cities. And the book is written for 6th grade to 12th graders. I think it's categorized as juvenile that way. You know, I read the book in an afternoon. It's not that difficult to get through. There's lots of interesting pictures and graphs and little subcharts. And then the text is very readable, but it's very approachable for everybody. I'm telling you, you will learn things in this you didn't know, and you'll just shake your head. It's kind of sad, but it's also a wonderful thing that these 11 women, in the case of the movie, and one of them was her grandmother, were able to rise up and become mathematicians who helped John Glenn get into space. That's the story of Hidden Figures, the movie. And again, the book is titled Hidden Human Computers, the Black Women of NASA. I'm John Williams, and this is WGN. President Obama speaks Tuesday night at McCormick Place. And folks were at 3 o'clock in the morning at McCormick Place today. Was it McCormick Place standing
McCormick
in line?
McCormick Place, yes.
Trying to get those tickets. And it was maybe it was one ticket per person. And it says right on there, hey, you cannot resell this. People immediately go to Craigslist and they start selling them. And prices are quoted as high as $2,500. I don't know if anybody's going to get that, but I'll bet you folks will pay $500 for one ticket to see that speech. I guess he couldn't do it in Grant Park, right, the way he did when he was elected, because there was room for everybody there. And, of course, that was free. That was free.
Well, 45 degrees on Tuesday even still.
Oh, really? It's going to be 45 degrees on Tuesday?
That's what we're saying. Yeah, 45, but rain. But who knows? It could be like, you know, when they plan this thing, it could be.
Well, people would stand in the rain. Why aren't they doing it outside? They could do, well, I guess because it's winter and it could be 10 below zero, too. So they have to plan it. And so they planned it inside McCormick. Is that the biggest indoor venue we have in the Twin Cities? In Chicago?
I think it probably is. I can't think of a larger one.
Where could you get more people indoors? Yeah. It's not United Center. It's not, you know, I'm trying to think of indoor spaces. That's probably the biggest one. How many people does that stand, I wonder?
That I don't know, but it probably depends on how much of it's being used because there's so much to it. You know, you go to the auto show and imagine the auto show with no cars. It's like
But you're right. Really, it's not one room, too. It's kind of go around here and over there. I don't know if the First Lady is going to speak. She spoke at an event this weekend or this week and was just so good. When Michelle speaks, she can just be so strong and sincere. I believe she was giving an award for achievement to guidance counselors, and she got teary at the end. She said, this will be my last public appearance, you know, giving a speech. And she was just delightful. So maybe she won't speak when the president does. Be interesting if the whole family does the wave. Boy, we saw them when they were 8 years younger, and the president had darker hair. And those girls were just lovely, and now they're a lot taller. And, you know, getting ready to go off to school.
And they didn't really get a lot of press coverage, I felt. The way,
I think
like,
you're
Chelsea
right.
Clinton, to me, felt like there was a lot of focus.
Oh, really? I think the Bush daughters got a fair amount.
Yeah.
But they were older, too, when they went, you know, when they went to the, moved into the White House.
But, yeah, Sasha Malia, it's like, oh, that's what they look like now. Okay.
Yeah, once in a while they pop up. But you know what? They shouldn't be in our eye unless they want to.
I agree, yeah.
You know, you saw a little video of one of them. Was it Malia or Sasha at, not Pitchfork.
She was at Lollapalooza, I think.
Where's it Lollapalooza?
I think so.
And it's video that they probably wish wasn't out there. I don't know. Griff, where are you on selling tickets to the speech on the secondary market?
I won't be doing it, if that's what you're asking.
Well, you don't have a ticket either.
No, I don't have a ticket. I don't know. I don't know. I don't really have a strong feeling either way.
But to me, that if that's how you feel about it, then you're okay with people doing it, too.
Yeah, I can see it feeling a little gross.
It doesn't bother me that much. And I'm not, because it just seems to me like it's an opportunity for somebody to go who would not otherwise have an opportunity to go. Think of it just from the perspective of the person who really wants to be there, but they live in Cleveland and they can't be in line Saturday morning or for whatever reason. Is it just because you weren't lucky enough to be near enough to that location, you can't go? So you say, well, all right, maybe that's arbitrary. How else could we, you know, arbitrate this? Well, let's say, how about whoever has the most money? And that's the way we do things in America sometimes. And besides, I think if I stood in line and it's 3 degrees above zero outside and I get a ticket, I've earned something, either a chance to watch the speech or I've earned something here that's of value to you and so I can sell it. As long as everybody's sort of on the same page in the room, I don't think I care that much how they got in there. Well, that's me anyway. You may have a different opinion. You can text to 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We'll read a couple of your observations about that. And the Mincing Rascals have a lot to say about the Chicago scene. Last weekend, did you see on 60 Minutes Sunday night how they portrayed the problem of shootings in Chicago? I thought that was very interesting and not perfect. The Rascals have a few things to say about that after the news. And are we going to play that quick spot here, guys, or are we going to go straight into the newsroom? Okay, the news in a few seconds here on WGN. Okay, thank you, Bob Kessler. This is John Williams at almost 1:36 on Saturdays about this time. We rebroadcast part of our podcast called The Mincing Rascals. The Mincing Rascals almost always features Chicago Tribune columnist Eric Zorn and editorial writer Kristen McQuarrie, and they are on today's podcast broadcast, as well as Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio News. The full podcast you can get wherever you get your finer podcasts. You can also find an easy link to it at WGNradio.com, or maybe you like the WGNplus.com platform. You can't miss it with the pretty little cartoon of us all right there. So here's part of what we talked about. In fact, we started talking about the 60 Minutes coverage last Sunday of crime in Chicago, the shooting specifically, and Eric Zorn had this to say.
I thought it was a good piece. I thought it was fair and alarming. But whenever I see these things, I also want to remind people from elsewhere in the country that this problem is fairly isolated in Chicago in terms of the neighborhoods that it hits. I mean, I live on the northwest side. I think, Kristen, where you live on the southwest side, it's not like murders are happening all around us or we're afraid to go to the bus stop. This is a problem that's afflicting these particular neighborhoods and areas, but it's really hitting them hard.
I think the story could have been more dramatic that way. I've always said that too, Eric. You know, I live in Minneapolis, and I have friends up here who think it's crazy that your kids are living in Chicago, John, or that you would go there. But it's not crazy at all. And if you really wanted to tell a frightening story, just pick those two or three or four neighborhoods and talk about life there. But they got Gary McCarthy saying that the police department is in a state of lawlessness. Kristen, do you think that's a apt sort of characterization of the CPD?
You know, I think it was correct that when the ACLU settled with the city and forced officers every time they make a stop to fill out a two-page form, that did, in fact, drop with the number of officers who are willing to do that, who are willing to do what is kind of ancillary police work where you're making proactive stops of people. But what I don't like about the 60 Minutes piece, and what I sort of cringe whenever out of town, you know, those all producers from New York City swooping in here trying to diagnose Chicago. This is an economic problem. This is a poverty driven problem. This is a problem with the city and its leadership and its 50 aldermen not focusing for a decade or more, two decades, on trying to improve the quality of life in some of these neighborhoods that are, to me, at this point, some of them almost lost causes with all of the foreclosures. I mean, when was the last time you guys drove to the southeast side or some of these neighborhoods on the south side? Some of them are literally hollowed out. It kind of bothered me that 60 Minutes, I consider it kind of lazy reporting to go to the former police chief, who, of course, has a grudge because he was shoved out, to go to Father Flager, who I appreciate the work that he does, but I mean, marches and continually, you know, crying for more resources is not going to solve this problem. I don't feel like they really did any, you know, in-depth reporting. They kind of went to the usual suspects.
How much of that is on Mayor Emanuel for not agreeing to an interview?
That did not bother me. You know, I don't know that I would trust the producers of any show like that to splice and dice what you're going to say and possibly...
if you're Rahm Emanuel, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Still, I thought he was conspicuously absent.
You did? I've heard that from other
there.
People, too. I just... Does he wear the jacket for this? Of course he does, because he's the mayor. But at the same time, him not sitting down to do yet another out of town. I mean, this is not the first time that news outlets, CBS, NBC, CNN, have tried to, you know, solve our problems here. And so the fact that he didn't sit down for this one,
How fair do we think it is that Gary McCarthy is portrayed as the fall guy for this? I mean, my reaction to that is usually that I think that...
All of the shootings, Eric?
No. Well, he was fired, as you remember, right after the Laquan McDonald tape came out. Suddenly, this was McCarthy's fault, and he has to go. Was he doing a terrible job, a comparatively terrible job, as police chief? Is he at all vindicated by the fact that murders have spiked in the past year?
He made the rounds then, and I didn't see the 60 Minutes piece. I don't know if this was part of it, but he was making the rounds the next day and was on WGN and also said that there was this sort of purge in the upper management level at the police department, and a lot of people then were forced up. And he said Eddie Johnson, the superintendent, was one of them. And he said, you know, I like the guy, I promoted the guy, but these guys have moved a level maybe beyond where their seasoning dictates they should be. So in other words, he was saying, Johnson's a good guy, but I don't think he's up to the job.
Well, they were incredulous on that report that the police officers aren't doing as many stops. And I thought a point that got lost was one of the reasons I think the cops do fewer stops is because if you're caught doing something wrong, then that's going to end badly for you. And you get the feeling that with these videos popping up everywhere, the cops aren't as willing to engage.
Well, that was certainly the message of the story. There was one of our colleagues tweeted out that actually New York has seen a similar drop in police stops and yet hasn't seen a similar rise in crime. So the correlation may not be causation in this case. So you have to be careful when you look at those various statistics, because that's certainly the implication of the story was that cops aren't stopping people, therefore more people are being murdered.
I think the other issue, too, that underlies all of this with police, too, is there has been a movement where delegitimizing the police has become mainstream and acceptable. I don't like to point to morale as being a big issue. You know, put on your big boy pants and go do your job. But at the same time, all of these conversations that we have about crime in Chicago keep falling on the police.
Right.
You can't put a police officer on every corner. A lot of this has to do with poverty and bad parenting and kids who are on social media now more so than ever and get angry. And I mean, we just had a case where 18-year-olds live streamed beating a special needs person over the course of 2 days while they kept him locked in a home. I mean, you can't keep thinking that changing the top of the police department, changing the superintendent, changing the command staff, adding more cops, it is a much bigger, bigger problem. And the conversation keeps falling on it's the police department's fault.
That's the
only thing 60 Minutes talked about.
And that's one of the things McCarthy makes, even though he might have said they're in a disarray or whatever. He said that this sort of the ultra focus on police has actually cost more lives than it is saved, because the police are withdrawing a little bit.
When they marched after Laquan McDonald, the police made sure that the protesters, the Black Lives Matter movement, had a safe space to protest. And at the same time, you had people antagonizing police, spitting at them, calling them pigs. You know, it's acceptable now to treat police officers in that way.
I did think the Father Flager 762 cross march was pretty dramatic, pretty effective in communicating how many people have been shot to death in the city. Did you guys get the same feel?
I did. Just the photograph of it. It was heart-wrenching.
Dramatic.
It really was.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. We talk about it a lot. That was say what you will about Father Flager's tactics sometimes, but I thought that one actually worked. Donald Trump said that we need more federal help, or the city of Chicago needs to ask for federal help if they can't get this thing under control.
What does that look like? What does federal help look like in this case? Is he talking about the National Guard? What's he talking
That's
about?
The only thing I was thinking was federal troops or National Guardsmen on street corners. I really don't know, Eric.
How about extra money to rebuild some of those neighborhoods and the schools down there and
I think
jobs
that's more what he was referring to.
Are you guys optimistic that that was just an anomaly, that it was a spike that will correct itself? Is the world so dramatically different in 2016 that we would have that kind of an increase? Maybe it'll correct itself back to the norm this time.
So far, I mean, I'm hoping and guessing that it will get back to under 500 murders in Chicago. So far,
that's a funny bar, but
the first couple days of 2017 have not been auspicious. I think there have been six people murdered already, and it's only
two of them 16-year-old kids.
It's not the thing that changes with the flip of the calendar, right. I don't think.
No, it isn't, but the question was whether that last 12-month period was just one of those statistical anomalies, or where they just happened to be. Because as John points out, why was 2016 so much different from 2015? What changed? And is it only the Laquan McDonald case? And I mean, you have to look for some root causes for that. And I'm not sure there are any that are.
Well, like Kristen says, none easily fixed. I'm going to go to something less important in a way, but this is Donald Trump's New Year's Eve tweet. Quote, "Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who have fought me and lost so badly they just don't know what to do. Love! Exclamation point. I think that may be the single most offensive thing he has tweeted since he got Twitter. I was stunned at that. I looked at it all day. I spent too much of New Year's Eve day looking at that thing. And then later in the day, he had two more tweets. Later, either it was either that evening and or the next morning. But he had two more traditional, let's all make America great again, generic feel-good tweets. But the first one, the one that maybe best spoke his sentiment, was, "Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who have fought me and lost so badly. They just don't know what to do. Love." And don't you love it when somebody uses that word as a sort of F-U? But there it was. That was the President-elect's New Year's Eve tweet to the nation. I could not get over that.
I was thinking coming in today about this podcast and about the chat we had right after he won and how, you know, we wish him well and that the country does well and maybe he'll surprise people. I don't think he's done a single thing. I don't think he's done a single thing to convince me that anything is going to be that he's up to it.
I mean, he's still running the campaign. He's still looking for enemies.
He's doing worse than that. I mean, every time he tweets and, you know, sides with Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange rather than the president of his country and does things like that, I've been unreassured. Absolutely unreassured.
I don't know. I can't reassure you. That tweet in particular, I fall back on. I think Steve brought it up at one of our podcasts that Trump supporters take him seriously, but not literally. No. And his opponents take him literally, but not seriously. And so I just kind of laugh off that kind of tweet nonsense. And I'm still holding out, Steve, for actual swearing in. The transition that happens when you are sworn in and you are president of the United States, there is a security protocol.
Is a ray of light going to come down, Kristen, and hit him on the forehead?
No, but I think that if he follows the rules, if he follows tradition.
That was going to happen when he secured the nomination. That was going to happen when he got the nomination. That was
going to
happen when he won.
But he's not sworn in yet. We still have an outgoing president of the United States, and I keep thinking that he will tone it down. He'll have to.
There was that speech on election night when he was claiming victory, and he sounded so sober and forward-looking and almost presidential that night. People think, well, this is the new Donald Trump. Of course, that didn't last. The thing about this tweet, first of all, people who were his enemies didn't lose really, really badly. They got more popular votes than he did. That's something to sort of keep in mind and remember that this was, you know, at best for him, it was a very close election.
I don't know what that even means to my many enemies. Who are those many enemies?
Well, I don't know, but they didn't lose so very, very badly. They came very, very close to winning this election. The Democrats are sort of figuring out now how they're going to fight him, and they've got plenty of ways to fight him, and certainly one of the ways they're going to fight him is to make him eat this promise he's made to repeal Obamacare right away without any plan in place to replace it.
Here's the thing, and we said this before, I said this before, as did others, that words don't matter, and I think with Donald Trump, nothing he says matters. And by that, I mean, he has no conviction behind what anything he utters. He will change it in a negotiation. He'll change it in a meeting. He'll change it in the next tweet. He does not put the weight to his words that the rest of us do. And right. I don't know which middle we're going to meet in.
Who was it that said after Barack Obama got elected the first time that the point of this Congress will be to keep him from getting anything done?
Mitch McConnell.
Aren't we on the cusp of doing that very thing to Donald Trump? If he can, or Republicans can, make health care program better, why in the world would we want to fight that?
I think that's what Obama has been saying. I think that's what he was rallying his troops, and he was saying, don't stand in their way.
Don't you think it's wrongheaded of Democrats to make a point to keep him from changing health care?
No, I think what they want to do is they want to make sure that the changes that he imposes have been scored, and we know how many people are going to lose their health care and what it's going to mean to all of them. I mean, the problem that the Republicans have is for 6 years they've been saying we want to repeal Obamacare, repeal it, repeal it, but they've never really agreed on any kind of plan to replace it. There are about six or seven different plans out there floating around. The Republican caucus is not united behind any one of them right now, and you can't just repeal it, because the thing is, if you take away the taxes that support Obamacare, you take away the subsidies, suddenly the whole thing does fall apart of its own weight.
But John, I think the point is they're not saying they want to fix Obamacare. They're saying they want to end it. And if they are going to end something that is working well for many people, I think the Democrats are saying, if you're going to destroy that, okay, you put up something new. If the ending it, the repealing of it, is you on your own, then you should be responsible for figuring out a solution, and don't look to us to take tough votes to help you do that.
Don't you think the new Republican plan is going to look a lot like the plan we have now?
Everything but the name.
Well put, Steve Bertrand. That's Steve Bertrand, Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune, of course, the columnist, and Krista McQuarrie, who sometimes columns and often editorializes in the Chicago Tribune. You can hear that full podcast. We go on and on for almost a half an hour at WGNplus.com or WGNradio.com, and you should subscribe to and share with your friends, the Mincing Rascals, wherever you get your finer podcast. So thanks to the gang. You have something to say about what you just heard there? We can take some phone calls or read some texts. Why is that, Griff? We've got something else going on here? Oh, we've already got a call lined up?
We're going to talk to somebody that was getting tickets.
Oh, okay. I thought we were going to do that at 2:20. Are we going to do that now?
Yeah, we're going to do that now.
Oh, okay.
I just told people that we weren't taking calls.
Oh, so wait. Yeah. Were we getting calls on that?
Just a couple, but it's fine. We have something else lined up.
Strident language by the host there. Did that sort of stir people up a little bit? Well, I'll tell you what then. We've got another call, a different topic coming up in just a minute, which I'm kind of interested in doing. But let's read some of the text. You can text to 312-981-7200 and tell us how swell you think we are there. 312-981-7200. Okay, back in a minute here on WGN. 154 WGN. Bob Kessler will do your news at 2 o'clock. In the 2 o'clock hour, we visit with Mara Einstein. Her book is Black Ops Advertising. It's funny when you're surfing around the internet. You know, you'll see in the trough on the side or sometimes popping up ads for things that you might be interested in. And we're all sort of interested in that. But she said more intriguing these days, more subtle, is what they call native advertising. You will be clicking on articles, sometimes on real big-time news sites like CNN or MSN or wherever you go to get your news, right? And you'll be clicking on things that really do look like news articles and are written to look like news articles, but it's paid content. And they will justify it by saying, oh, no, we put a little indicator there, but the indicators are getting smaller. And the difference between advertising and journalism or content is getting smaller. She's got a few things to say about that. And if nothing else, it's good to know what's what. So she's helping us keep score after 2 o'clock. I was talking about the fact that you can get tickets to see Barack Obama's last speech Tuesday night at McCormick Place. You had to stand in line early this morning, but now they're online. You can buy them on the secondary market. You're not supposed to. A friend of mine texted me while we were talking about that and said, we were there. We got tickets. His name is Mark Peterson. Hey, Mark, how are you? Are you there, Mark? Okay, he's going to jump in here in just a second.
Maybe he's frozen solid from the experience.
He can't. That's right, he's standing outside and he can't move his jaw.
Steve, hey, Mark, are you there? Steve Bertrand's son was there, too.
Hey, John, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can. We were worried about you. We thought we lost you for good. So Steve Bertrand's son was out there, too?
Yeah, Noah was.
Wow. Well, how many people will be at that? Did you get any sense, Mark, of how many people will actually be able to see the farewell speech?
You know, I didn't, but the line was at least a half mile long. It went all the way to 18th Street for people that are familiar with the McCormick Place area. It was freezing, too. We were outside for about 2.5 hours.
What was the temperature when you were out there?
You know, my phone said it was 5, so I don't know what the wind chill was. But it was funny when they let some people in. They'd let them in groups of 20, and you'd hear cheers because people were freezing and they just wanted to get inside to get warm.
You stood outside in 5-degree temperatures in the cold dark for 2.5 hours?
We did. My son and I did. That's how bad we want to do this.
Does Polly know about this?
She does.
Because a lot of moms won't let their kids and husbands do that, but what a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Did everybody know? Obviously, a lot of folks did, but, I mean, how did you find out that that was the time and place to be?
Well, we read about it online, and we got in the area about 5:40, and there was tons of people there already. The traffic was backed up, and there were hundreds of people running towards the gate four near the Hyatt where the line was forming. So people were taking turns going into the Hyatt to warm up. So you'd be with your partner in line, somebody would go in, and then, you know, you take turns doing that to try to keep warm.
Were you worried that all of that would be for naught? I mean, how did you know if, in fact, you were going to get tickets?
We were worried for a little bit, but once we got inside, they had people circulating saying that you're definitely getting tickets. So it was good at that point. Once we got inside, too, we probably had to wait about an hour inside as well. So it was a pretty long process.
Were they very specific about instructions about the tickets, no sale or resale, that sort of thing?
No, not at all. The people that were working there were cheering everybody that was getting tickets, high-fiving. It was kind of a festive atmosphere, so it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, talk about the people that were in line with you, Mark.
Well, it was really a mixture of all ages, all races. People were obviously talking in line with each other. It became a lot of fun because you were there so long. It's just a nice mix of people.
Did it remind you at all of Grant Park? Were you at Grant Park when he got elected?
I didn't. I was not there, no.
Yeah, I was there. And it's funny. I remember Kristen Decker, one of our producers, and I were there. And we were walking around. And it was, a lot of African-Americans, people of color, of course. But it was like you said, it was a real rainbow of people, ages, and all sorts of descriptions. But the one thing I do remember was that as people were streaming into Grant Park hours ahead of time, and it was a festive atmosphere, is that they were wearing T-shirts that said something, and I couldn't quote one of them to you offhand, but I think Kristen and I even made a video of all the people's T-shirts, and we said, explain to us why you're wearing this. And it was always either very personal or very, large, some, Make America Great kind of message 8 years ago, hope and change or something like that. And I wondered if you got a sense of how personally important it was to people while you were standing in line.
I think it was very important to a lot of the people that were there. It was just, it's hard to explain, but it was a very festive atmosphere. Especially as we got closer in, they cheered when you got in. And then once you got closer to getting your tickets, everybody started cheering, and the staff was high-fiving. So I think for the most part it was really, moving for a lot of people. I know my son feels that way.
Yeah. You're going to sell it online, of course. I mean, you can get thousands for that thing.
No, I think I'm going.
Yeah.
But I don't have a problem with people selling it, but I'm definitely going.
Yeah, well, then we'll have to talk again maybe next Saturday, or maybe somebody on staff will talk to you next week, because you will be there. Have a great time, and I'll visit with you down the road.
Sounds good. Thanks, John. Take care.
That's a friend of mine named Mark Peterson, and so he'll be at McCormick with some folks. Okay, it's 2 o'clock. It's time for the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. All right, thank you, Bob. This is John Williams, and happy Saturday to you. I don't know what's going on at your house, but at my house, Brenda is putting away the Christmas decorations. Have you de-Christmased your house, Bob? Are you all back to normal?
No, I have a little Christmas hanging thing, and my cards are up on a little ledge, so they're still there. Maybe
some
next
people
week,
hang on to it because they, why get rid of Christmas? Keep it as long as can. If your tree's still up on Valentine's Day, you've crossed the line. I don't know where the line is.
We're talking fire hazard.
We're talking tacky hazard. It's just wrong. You shouldn't have it up in February, I'd say. I don't know when the line
Move
is
on.
Or where it is.
Move on to President's Day or something.
I know. Pick one. Inauguration Day might be a good one. Find some line in the sand and say, after this, the tree has to come down or something like that. So for us in my house, it is this weekend. And so there's a little hostility. It's work. It's, lots of boxes going this way and coming out that way. But it's also kind of a refreshening of the house. It's like, okay, thank you, Christmas. That was fun. Hey, what do you know? We got a new room here. It's no longer red and green. It's brown and whatever. And that's good, too. I'm really enjoying a book called Black Ops Advertising. It's by Mara Einstein, who is an author and is a professor of media studies at Queens College, City University of New York, and an independent marketing consultant. She and I have spoken about this before, and I've enjoyed our conversation enough that I asked her to join us this Saturday afternoon here on WGN. Mara, it's John Williams. Welcome again. How are you?
Doing great. A little snowy here in New York, but doing good.
Yeah, so what are you guys getting? We know it hit the eastern seaboard and more, I thought, to your south, but you're getting it too, huh?
Yeah, no, they said 1 to 3 inches, but I think it's going to be more than that.
But New York City doesn't get snow like Chicago does, I don't think. Do you all? I mean, you're still a coastal town.
Yeah, well, we do. Well, you know, I went to business school in Chicago, so I know what Chicago winters are like, too. It's not quite as cold here, but we certainly get hit pretty good.
What business school did you go to in Chicago?
Kellogg.
Oh, no kidding. I've heard of them. Well, then, all hail Mara. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Why do you call it black ops advertising?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is anyone who's worked in advertising and marketing for any period of time knows that the way that we talk about marketing uses very militaristic terms. We talk about objectives and strategies and tactics. And you and I, when an ad is being directed to us, we are the target. So all of those are very militaristic sort of terms. So the next level of the military is to do things more covertly, right? So we hear about black ops or black operations in terms of what the military is doing. So the same thing is true is going on in terms of advertising and marketing, in that we're starting to see more covert forms of advertising, which is in response to people trying to avoid advertising.
Yeah.
You know, we've learned, right, over the decades to find ways not to have to engage with advertising. So first it was the remote control, and then it was TiVo or DVRs. And now in the online space, it's ad blockers. And they even call it, you know, ad avoidance or banner blindness, that the advertising is there and we don't even see it. And so the way for marketers to try and work around that, particularly in terms of ad blockers, is to create advertising that doesn't look like advertising. So that's why I call it black ops. It's covert.
Is that what's known as native content?
Yeah, native advertising. So native advertising is advertising that's created to look native to the site within which it exists. So if we're on Facebook or you're on Twitter or something like that, that you'll see something within the news feed that looks exactly like everything else that appears on the site. The particular site that does this very well is, of course, BuzzFeed. They're known for it probably more than anybody else. And so it might be a cat video, or it might be they have those listicles, you know, lists of things in, you know, which Fraggle Rock character are you, or what are the 10 things you need to buy to go before you go back to college. And then you find out that it's actually an ad for Target that's trying to sell you all those things you need to buy to go to college. But it's not just those. It's also custom, what's known as custom native, which is a bit more insidious, because those are the things like that appear in traditional newspaper websites like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or Washington Post, and they look like an article. They have a headline, they have a byline, which is not something that we would expect. It has the name of the author attached to it, and that's not something we would expect to see in something that we're looking to be an ad.
Yeah. What do you say about that? What this is interesting, and I think as you sort of click these things off, a lot of us are going, oh, yeah, right, been there, done that. What should my reaction to that be? I mean, what are you saying about this?
Well, you know, some of these things is not – you know, it's not really a horrible thing necessarily. If it's an ad for, you know, cat food, it's not something that people are going to get particularly disturbed about. What the problem starts to be is when you have companies that really have a vested interest in swaying our ideas about larger issues, that we begin to get into some really questionable territory. So if you have Goldman Sachs doing an ad in the New York Times right after the recession, and they were trying to really make it look like they were the good guys in terms of helping to revive the economy, and they weren't, then it gets to be questionable. Same thing's true with Shell Oil, which does an awful lot of native advertising, and they're trying to push ideas about environmentalism and sustainability. But, of course, they have a vested interest in presenting an idea that, you know, maybe going too far down the track of using wind turbines is not a great thing, right? And so understanding that somebody behind a particular message has a biased idea about how people should be thinking about something is a problem.
And right, really, but everybody should have an opinion, right? I mean, corporations get to have a voice. You know, you would see, for instance, a full-page ad in the Chicago Tribune by Mobil Oil, and it would talk about maybe petroleum issues, and it would be seen as advertising but also editorial. You don't mind that they speak their piece, do you?
No, and really what a number of the people that I spoke to when I was researching the book said to me, look, we're in this industry, and so we know it better than anybody else, which is really true. And I'm sure there are people that are listening who work in a particular industry. You're in it day in and day out, and you know it better than anybody does. And that's for sure. The issue starts to be if somebody who's reading that particular piece of content doesn't know that there's an advertiser behind it.
Okay, and then who are you mad at in that case? Are you mad at Mobil Oil, say, or are you mad at the Chicago Tribune or CNN for making it look like it's a CNN story?
Well, that's, you know, a little bit of both, frankly. I think the pendulum is going to start to turn a little bit. You know, on the one hand, the publishers like the Times or CNN or any of these other organizations, they've really got hit hard on the advertising side. So what happened is a lot of money started going out of so-called legacy media like radio and television and started moving into the digital space. And when that happened, these companies lost a lot of money because advertising online costs a lot less money than it does to put an ad in the hard copy of the newspaper or onto CNN. And so they needed to come up with new ideas to figure out ways to get people to advertise in the online space and pay more money for it. What's starting to happen, though, is advertisers are starting to say, well, maybe this native stuff is a little too native. And if people don't understand that there's an advertiser behind it, you know, how much is this actually doing for me as an advertiser?
Well, it will say paid content, or it will say featured content or sponsored content. There, different sites have different words. What do you make of that as being sufficient to have warned people that this is an advertisement you're looking at?
Right. It's not. It's decidedly not. Part of the issue is that there's no uniformity in terms of how any of this content is labeled. Some say, like just as you suggest, John, some of it says sponsored content, some says a promotion partner, some says promoted, and it's all very confusing to people, so much so that there was research that was done out of the University of Georgia that said only 8% of people were able to determine that that native advertising was, in fact, advertising.
Really?
And even really. And more recently, a similar kind of research was done out of Stanford, and close to, I believe the number was 70% of middle schoolers. So you figure, you know, these are people who are very savvy in the online space, you know, they think they know what they're looking at and so on, and 70% of middle schoolers were not able to determine that what they were looking at was advertising, which begs for us to be doing a lot more media literacy work.
Yeah, no kidding. Mara Einstein's on the phone line. Her book is Black Ops Advertising. Naturally, I'm about to say this, but I'm a little sorry to hear about this because advertising is not a bad thing. First of all, it's targeted messaging, and businesses want you to know about them. And you, in fact, whether you like it or know it or not, you want to know what businesses have to offer. That communication is called advertising, and generally it's paid for to radio stations, newspapers, or the digital spaces. That's not inherently a bad thing. And I want people to think about this. That's how you get information. That pays the freight. So if we found a way to perfectly eliminate all advertising from your eyes and ears, then guess what? The New York Times goes away, and CNN goes away, and Fox News goes away. It all goes away if you don't have advertising. Somebody has to pay the freight, Mara.
Yep, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I come out of advertising, and I used to work at NBC. I used to work at MTV Networks. And so I see where this all came from. And I worked at those places in the 80s and the 90s. And what I saw in talking with a lot of these sort of new marketing folks going on now is they've gotten so enamored with digital advertising and marketing. And it has its place. Absolutely, it has its place. But it has so overwhelmed the landscape without people taking a breath to say, you know, how is all this stuff going to get paid for? And one of the things that, for instance, that I talk with my students about is I will say to them, do you watch television? And they will all say no. And then I'll say, well, do you watch The Walking Dead? And they all say yes. I'm like, okay, well, where do you think that comes from? And so when they begin to put it together that this content doesn't magically appear on their computer screen, and actually what was interesting was last semester we had a number of programs that were shooting on campus, and so they could see the trucks come, and they could see the union guys come, and all of that work being done, and begin to understand what the costs are behind producing that kind of content. And it's very different to watch a show like The Walking Dead than it is to watch a video that's produced by somebody who's sitting in front of their computer for YouTube. And somebody's got to pay for that. I'm not sure I have all the answers. I have ideas that I would love people to try. For instance,
okay, hold on. Let's leave it. Hold on right there. I'm going to pause. I'm going to play some commercials. It'll be very apparent. They'll have jingles. An announcer will probably speak quickly. We'll come back and then give us some of those takeaways that you've got. And I also have, I want to share with you this, Mara. I have an idea I've long promoted for what I think would be the way to pay for content for internet use for television. And I think it's perfect. Do you want to know what it is?
What's that?
Well, you have to wait after the commercial break. Okay. We'll come back. Mara Einstein's on the line, and her book is Black Ops Advertising. Here is some traditional advertising coming your way on WGN. Mara Einstein's on the line. Her book is Black Ops Advertising. She said that this native content advertising that appears as articles online is kind of sneaky. You need to at least be aware of it. But also, what else should we know about this, Mara?
Well, in terms of what we were talking about before the commercial break, was what's happened is that as money has moved online, we've got less money supporting the kind of content that people want to, you know, spend a lot of time interacting with,
yeah.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with advertising. There's some really good advertising out there, and I'd be the first one to tell you so. The issue becomes when it becomes hidden, and we don't have time to talk about it, but this actually gets very much into the whole issue of fake news that's been going around of late. But to get to the issue of what some of the answers are to this, one is that people need to understand, as you were talking about before, that advertising is what supports and pays for the content that most of us watch and read. And what has begun to happen, and I know I've seen it for myself, and I'm sure some of your listeners do too, is that you're beginning to pay piecemeal for content. And it's beginning to add up, and some of this is because we think we're not getting advertising. And why I say that is we think is I'm sure a lot of people have subscriptions to Netflix. But the fact of the matter is there is advertising in Netflix, and there's a tremendous amount of product placement in the television shows that they produce, meaning that there's products that aren't necessarily spoken about, but appear within the individual television, quote-unquote, television shows that appear
yeah.
on those networks.
We've seen that before, and I wonder how people feel about that. Do they mind if, God, we laughed out loud at one of the Hallmark Channel's Christmas movies mm-hmm. that we were watching this year because the camera went over to a cup of Maxwell House coffee or whatever it was, and
right,
it hung
right.
there for, like, way too long. And then it
right,
sort of came back,
right.
and you rolled your eyes, but it didn't seem to be as invasive, you know. It was just bad television for a couple of seconds.
Right, right. Well, I think that there's – two sides of that. One is there's sometimes when product placement is used where it sort of fits within the flow of the program, and all of that is fine. It's when you have those kind of glitches about what you're talking about that interrupts the flow of the programming, which tends to create the issues for people when they're watching that. There are some really egregious examples of products overtaking a particular television episode, and I think those are the kinds of things that people would avoid. There was one that was with Seventh Heaven and Oreo cookies. The whole script was about Oreo cookies. You wanted to throw something at the TV set when you saw an Oreo cookie coming on by the end of that particular program.
Well, I would get nervous is if, say, CNN decided to do something about the petroleum industry or energy or pollution, and Mobil Oil had paid them to at least do a factual story that presented their side. I don't know if anything like that is happening, but it seems like we're perilously close to that, aren't we?
Well, there have been some documentaries that have been done on National Geographic that are paid for either by petroleum companies or General Electric did one about scientists and things like that. And while they may claim that they're impartial about the content that's being produced, you can't help as a producer of the show to know who is paying for the thing that you are producing. So there are going to be things that are going to be left out if they are, in fact, negative against the person who's paying the bills. Mm. You can't help but have that begin to happen.
Well, my grand idea, Mara, but I mentioned to this too before the news, is I think that if we all agree that somebody has to pay the freight, I mean, we say we're in the golden age of television, and you said everybody's trying to avoid television commercials. Folks, at some point, you ain't going to get those shows if we all don't agree that we should find some way to pay for that. And it's not just TV shows. It's online content, and there's more now than ever. Somehow, somebody has to pay for that. And my attitude is, you should be charged per click. Your browser would have a counter in it, and you would have an account, like a PayPal account, if you will, attached to your credit card, and you would be charged every time you click on a page, every time you click on a view, every time you click on a video, a song, an ad, whatever. You wouldn't be charged much. It would be a fraction of a cent, and you click thousands of times a day. You're really deciding what you want to see with your mouse, and if it was a 50th of a cent, and you do it 5,000 times, then you'd get a bill for that amount. And to me, that would be a fairly apt scorekeeper of your interest, and you should pay accordingly. And I want to keep the bill less than a newspaper subscription or equivalent to it, you know what I mean? But something like that, to me, would solve this problem.
The only reason why I disagree with that idea is that what's happening now is every time we click on the mouse, somebody is using that information and they're using it against us, right? And so the data brokers and the ad networks and so on and the people on those individual sites are actually using us. I think they should be paying us for our information as opposed to us having to pay to go to those sites. But what I think we could do is, I mean, realistically, you know, advertisers knew that people weren't watching every single ad that popped up. But say there was a 3-minute pod in the middle of a television show or a 3-minute pod at the beginning like PBS does. And people, not everybody, but enough people would sit and watch that it would be able to pay for the content. And since it would be a limited amount of advertising, they could charge a lot more money for it.
When you listen to some of the better podcasts are that way. Malcolm Gladwell's podcast begins with such a sincere ad at the beginning. You almost want to patronize it so that he'll continue to fund the podcast that he's doing. You know what I mean?
Right. And the good content that spills over onto the advertising and becomes a win-win for everybody.
We are out of time. Mara Einstein's book is called Black Ops Advertising. And I'll just say one last thing about this. We're out of time, Mara. I hope you could join us again. But the book, I don't know when you wrote this, but it feels like you finished writing it last night. It's so current.
Thank you.
And your take on the Red Bull dive out of the space capsule – is the opening chapter, and it's appropriate. It's fascinating what you say about all of this. So if you have somebody who's clicking or studying or interested in this area, Black Ops Advertising, Mara Einstein. Okay, Mara, nice to visit.
And if you could, if people could come, I blog on my website at maraeinstein.com if you want to hear more recent stuff. I put it up all the time.
M-A-R-A, Mara Einstein, just like you'd think, maraeinstein.com. Okay, Mara, we'll visit again. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much, Don. Appreciate it.
Almost 2:32. We went long. We'll get you the news next here on WGN. That girl is a real crowd, please. Small world, all the friends know of me. Young bull living like an old geese. Quick release the cash, watch it fall slowly. Frat girl still trying to get in. Haters mad for whatever reason. Smoke in the air, binge drink. They lose it when the DJ. Thank you, Bob Kessler. John Williams here. This is WGN Radio, and this is our Vibe Score segment where we take a look at a bunch of things that are going on in your world, and we ask you to score them. Hold on a second. Where's my music? Here's my music. There's my Vibe Score music. Vibe Score is an app you can get for free. I hope you do. It's invented by my cousin Tom Hegberg and me, and we feed you stories of topics you're interested in, and we ask you a scorable question at the end. We always start with a musical vibe. Why are you playing Black Beatles, Griff?
Black Beatles is the number one song in America right now.
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty good song.
You like that song?
I do. Well, you know, it's kind of in my ear because of all of those videos everybody posts.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it takes a little it's good that those videos introduced it to you over and over, because once it's in your head, you're like, this song rules, I think. And the first time I heard it, I didn't think it was anything special. And then, like a lot of songs by that group, it's a duo, Race Remmerd. They grow on you.
How did that come to be? Was that them, or did somebody
know.
Let's have everybody do a human mannequin, and then we'll just use this as the background?
I honestly, I wish I knew. Maybe the answer is out there somewhere. I'm not really sure. Because I thought it must be something they do in the music video, then people just copy the music video. But then I watched the video, and I don't think they do it. So I don't really know.
Because if this was their sort of Black Ops Advertising, this sort of a marketing scheme for the song, I'll be outraged. I want it to be natural.
I think anything that's that successful as that one came to be is...
Yeah.
You can't fake it online. For some reason, people can smell when it's not real.
Yeah, right. Well, think about it. Did you know the song Harlem Shake before everybody? Yeah, you did. You probably did know the Harlem Shake song. I didn't.
No, I don't think so.
Do the Harlem Shake. So we are now listening to that song and vibing on it. I'm going to give that song 92.
Nice. Yeah, I'm right around there too. Actually, 90. I think it's a good hit. Good number one. Okay, in the movies category, Fences in Theaters Now, directed by and starring Denzel Washington, adapted from the play by August Wilson, and he wrote the screenplay, too, before his death. Viola Davis also co-stars, and there's Oscar buzz for them both.
She's great in that movie. She's great.
Oh, so you saw it?
Fences, yeah.
What's
the whole thing? I think it's way too long, and I don't like it that much.
Oh, no.
And it feels terrible because it's an important show, and it blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's great.
What's your problem other than it's too long?
It feels very theatrical, very stagey.
Well, it's adapted from the play, yeah.
Got it. So, you know, they I think, purposely kept that feel to it.
Yeah.
I also think it's just a little too much of a vanity project for him. I mean... Boy, if you want to see Denzel Washington act, you get 2 hours and 48 minutes of him doing that. It just goes
two hours and 18 minutes.
It's 138 minutes
so
long.
So 2 hours, 18 minutes.
18 minutes. But I'm telling you, I think they could have cut this movie down. I wanted to watch it, but I was exhausted when it was done.
Mm.
So that's my...
Well,
okay,
I'm really...
My vibe score on Fences is, stand by, 77.
That's extremely... What?
What is that extremely? What is extremely?
It's extremely high for the pan that you just delivered. What do these scores mean?
Oh, it could have been 100. It could have been 80, 85, 90. All right, fine, Griff. 72.
No.
Final answer.
I'm happy with it higher because I'm regretting that I haven't seen it. I'm really excited to. I've heard great things. So
maybe you'll like it.
I wish that we could duke it out, but I just haven't seen it yet.
Yeah,
but no, it's funny when you...
Dog you were expecting a 27, right?
Or, no, maybe like a 55 or something. I don't
okay,
know. But
fine. I'll change my vibe.
You don't 55. Have to.
Fine. No, Denzel, if you're listening, you're now a 55 in my book.
I want to see the score higher, but when you say the things you did, all right, never mind, whatever.
Hidden Figures is a lot better, let me tell you that.
You haven't seen Hidden Figures, though.
I have not, but the trailer looks awesome.
We have to, it's the same conversation every week. We just got, I'm not going to get over it, though, so you have to change. Otherwise...
Why can't I endorse a movie that I know is good and has an awesome trailer? What is your problem?
Lobster. Bob, who does the news every week with us, still thinks you've seen The Lobster. He asked me this morning, I thought your dad liked that movie.
I finally did see it. I endorsed it for about a half a year because it looked awesome. Then I went and saw it, and I changed my review to, it's not a very good movie. That's where I am on The Lobster.
I know. Do you... It doesn't matter. Okay. Well, then what are your... I know you haven't seen Silence. What do you think of it, though? How good is it? The new Martin Scorsese movie starring Adam
my
Driver.
My friend Kathy O'Malley walked out on it, so I'm going to give it a 39. Final answer. How
she
about
did.
That?
Yeah, I saw that post on Facebook. She walked out.
If and she Kathy said, is a great arbiter of things movie. If Kathy doesn't like it, it's a bad movie.
I know. I'm excited to see that one, too, but I... Yeah, after hearing that, I'm a little dissuaded. But she said the only movies she's walked out of in the last 10 years or something are Silence, the new one from Martin Scorsese, and Hot Tub Time Machine. That's what she said.
Martin.
For the same reason? Or
I think they suffer. Wow. They have a lot of the same problems, yeah.
That's just not a thing I normally associate with Martin Scorsese, is Hot Tub Time Machine. Okay. Well, what was she doing watching that anyway?
I like that movie, too, as well. So that makes me think that there's still hope for Silence.
All right, what's our next vibe?
In TV, The Bachelor is back on ABC.
Oh, yeah. This is terrible.
Nick, who has been on the show 4 times, is now the star of this season. They just can't get rid of him.
Wait a minute. So was he one of the guys all along?
He was one of the guys.
And now he has his own show.
Yeah, but that's how it usually works. But he was one of the guys and then went to do one of like the Bachelor spinoff shows. Then he was one of the guys again on The Bachelorette. So he's tried with 2 different women. And then he's just been around for like 15 years. Not that
it's
long.
It's sort of like divorces. You know, if you marry a guy who's been divorced 5 times, then that's on you. If you hook up with a guy who's been 4 times on the Bachelor franchise, that's kind of on you, hun. You've been warned.
He didn't do any really bad things, right? He wasn't like some of these guys go in and they say nasty things to people and they're, you know, they get really drunk and pass out in the middle of the beach after a night of insulting people. This guy was just kind of a quote normal guy.
Sort of. He's very divisive. Some people did not like him at all. He was cast as a villain a couple of those first times, but then. They sort of tried to make him into the nice guy on the last season he did.
So what are we vibing on here? Him or this season?
The new season, yeah. Which is probably, your feeling on that is probably, you know, determined
similar, yeah.
by how much you like Nick. I did watch the premiere episode.
I can't, really, what did you think, Griff?
I don't know. It's all about, I just have to watch it with people. It's always going to be bad. But
yeah,
it's just how much do you enjoy how bad it is. And this one, I was actually disappointed in Nick. Thought he was boring.
Oh, really?
And yeah. I'd give it like a 55.
55. I give it a 56, just to tweak you a little bit there. I don't like the whole franchise. When it first came out, I thought that was kind of fun. I cannot believe there is still a Bachelor anything on TV.
It got a late surge, I feel. It gets just like new life a couple years ago.
Oh,
I think from Twitter. I don't really know why, but
People are vibing on that. Well, give us another show.
The OA on Netflix. It's a new science fiction series for Netflix original. So the whole first season just dropped a couple weeks ago. Have you heard anything about this? I just watched the pilot.
The first one. Every time I hear that a lot. Have you heard about this one? And I think, oh, no, I haven't heard about that one. I consume a lot of television, it seems to me, or I'm aware of a lot.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know this one. There's just so much.
There's too much, yeah. And it's also like, do you want to... It's hard to tell if it's worth your time, so then by the time you're convinced that you should watch it, it's been over and people have moved on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's so true, yeah.
Well, so the OA is the latest science fiction hot series on Netflix.
Yes.
And you can vibe on that.
It's about a woman who's been missing for like 7 years or something. She comes back and people want to know where she's been and she has a hard time explaining, which is frustrating for the characters in the show, and I understand that. But then it, at a certain point, it's also frustrating for the viewer. I didn't love the first episode, but I'll probably watch another, and if it doesn't get better, then I might be out. Because
Did you watch that series, Rectify?
No. But I remember you talked about it with Brian Tallarico from Roger Ebert last week.
Yeah, that everybody that's seen that, and okay, I know two or three people, but boy, they loved it. It really consumes you. Let's do celebrities, Griff.
Okay, yeah. Dev Patel has a new movie called Lion out right now that's nominated for a bunch of Golden Globes. And Ellen says he's the sexiest man alive. She even mocked up a People cover for him. Do you think she's right? We're going to...
I think he looks terrific. I mean, I saw that mock-up, but he's lifted weights. He's grown his hair out. He always had a nice smile. And you know what I think makes him look really attractive? I don't know if sexy is the word, but he just seems like such an intelligent, empathetic fella. You know, how can you not be attracted to that? Uh-huh. So I don't have a number for him off the top of my head, Griff. I've never felt that way for another man, but
go ahead.
Yeah. I'm there for him. I'm there for you if you are a big Dev Patel fan.
Well, it's one of those things. We first were introduced to him when he was so young. Yeah. But you just think of him as a very boyish face, so you have to do like a double take when because he's looking very grown now.
It makes you want to go back and watch Slumdog Millionaire.
It does, yeah.
I've seen in promoting this movie, they cut back to that, and it makes me want to watch that, if not Lion.
I give it a 90. He's looking great. And then it's like what happened with John Krasinski, the guy from The Office. I don't know if you followed this at all, but he played Jim on The Office
sure.
for that really long time. He's just a skinny, good-looking guy. And then last year, he was in the Benghazi movie by Michael Bay, so then he's like an action hero, and he's got the hugest muscles. It's very weird to look at him like,
oh no,
It doesn't work for everybody because I looked at him like, oh, freaking me out a little bit.
I don't want that. That doesn't go with the package I have for him.
I don't know. Yeah.
That's funny.
He looks great. Whatever.
All right. Chicago sports. Do one more.
Yeah. 19 Chicago Bears went on the injured reserve this past season. And also they did not do very well. I don't know if you heard about that. it was a bad season.
It came up.
Should John Fox get fired, get another chance?
So we're vibing John Fox. 100, he comes back. He's the best coach ever. 0, get rid of him, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Fox. You know, I don't know you personally, but I've heard people cussing your team up and down for about 4 months here. So I'm going to give him a 26. I have a 26 for John Fox getting another chance on a scale of 1 to 100. Where are you, Griff?
Yeah, sure. I'm no expert.
I do that to people. Nobody works harder than NFL coaches. And nobody's, you know, sort of tenure, I think, is more perilous than an NFL coach's, too. I feel bad for these guys and their families. But 26. So but having said that, 26.
Yeah. You
know, that's what I got to do.
Fair enough.
All right. That's our weekly segment called Vibe Score. You can subscribe to the Vibe Score app wherever you get your apps. It's free. We'll pause here. The boys from the beat, maybe I'll ask them how they feel about that too. Next on WGN. So we did our Vibe Score segment. Let's ask the boys from the beat today. It's Kevin Powell and Mark Carmen. On a scale of 1 to 100, 100 is you've got to bring him back. He'll lead us to the Super Bowl. And 0 is get rid of them. How much love do you have for the Bears coach, guys? What would you say? What's the number? And now I don't hear anything. I don't hear them. I hear me. Guys, if you hear me, I'm sorry. I don't hear you. Talk amongst yourselves.
What was the Vibe Score question? I'll answer it for you.
Oh, now
I'll
hear
give
Bob.
You my take.
Oh, hey, Bob, I hear you. Hey. Are they around, Kevin and Mark? I thought they were going to jump
I don't
in.
See them in my array of monitor things.
I'm right here.
Oh.
I'm looking at you, Bob Kessler.
Hey, there you are. Hi, Mark Harmon.
Hi, John. Good to hear you. Good to be with you.
Yeah, long time. How you been?
I've been great. Happy New Year. It's been a wonderful time of New Year's resolutions, John. I feel outstanding coming into 2017. I've got a list a mile long.
Are these your sports New Year's resolutions?
I have sports. I have regular. I have work resolutions. I have... health resolutions.
You know, half the time when I'm talking to you, I think it's more like you're laying down on a couch, just speaking extemporaneously, and you kind of have forgotten that you're supposed to be doing a sport report. You know we're on the air right now, right, Mark?
Sometimes I do, John. Right now, well, it was, you know, I, hey, You want the real me, right?
We get all Mark Carmen when we get you, man. There's no holding back. I love that. Is Kevin Powell going to join you today?
Kevin Powell is walking in right now. He went across the street. We needed a little bit of a Starbucks situation.
Need a little caffeine in our lives.
And here he is. Look at that, John.
Hi, John. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. All right, so let me ask you guys. 100, the coach comes back. 0, we get rid of him. What's your vibe score for Mr. Fox?
John Fox?
Yeah.
100.
100, we keep him. 0, we get rid of him. Yeah. I would say 100.
100. Oh, really? Yeah. I gave him a 27. How about you, Carmen?
He's coming back, John. He's
but I mean, do you like that? You want?
Oh, do I like it?
Yeah, I think you give Fox one more year. My biggest issue is the fact their offensive coordinator is likely coming back, Dow Loggins. It's some of the worst offensive play calling I've seen for a Bears team in a long, long time. Just horrible. And then they, you know, the scapegoat has become an offensive line coach and an assistant defensive backs coach. There's no accountability there.
First off, I never would have hired John Fox. Then I would have fired him last season. Then I would have fired him in the middle of this season. Then I would fire him now. So my answer would be 0.
I'm going to go with you would fire him. What are you guys talking about today? Football or what else is on your mind?
Well, we do have the NFL playoffs going on here. We got a couple guests on the show, too, for the local action. We got Vincent Goodwill talking Bulls. A lot of rumors around Jimmy Butler. We got Blackhawks action as well coming up here with Scott Darling had an unbelievable game last night, John.
Really did.
So
I missed it. No, but a lot of stops, a lot of good stuff.
I believe 39 saves.
You know, we were talking to Eddie Olczyk yesterday, and I asked him if the Crawford Darling duo is the best in hockey, and it's hard to make an argument against that. They've stolen games for the Blackhawks this year, and the team's talked about it all season. They haven't even played to their full ability yet, and they're still in first place. A large part of that is because of the goaltending.
Hey, John, before you go, have you ever been in a press box, sports press box?
A couple times.
What would you say your experience was?
Well, I was always the odd man out because when I'm in a press box, nobody acts like they're having fun. And I know they're all working, but every now and then I'll go, yeah! Right. And then I'll look around and they'll look at me like, who let the idiot in?
Right.
So it's a bunch of just guys whose pants are way too tight and nobody seems to be enjoying it. And I know they love it because this is their careers. It's their passion.
Right. So that's you just hit on exactly where we're going. There was a guy that got kicked out of the Philadelphia Eagles press box over the weekend. They were having an argument, and that was not okay for a press box.
It wasn't even so much an argument. It was a discussion amongst beat reporters about a play that happened on the field, and there was some confusion, and the media relations department for the Philadelphia Eagles didn't like that.
You can't disrupt the hardworking media, John.
Why are you laughing, Kevin? Why is that so funny?
Because I think Carm's mocking the media a bit. It is pretty uptight in the press boxes. If you've been to any sporting event, it's really tight. And just a few feet away, there's some guy with his shirt off, chugging a beer, cheering for the players on the field. It's strange.
I had this interesting introduction to that, Kevin. I was sitting. So I go to a lot of Timberwolves games. The station I do my Monday through Friday show on is the station for the Minnesota Timberwolves. So I can sit with the press corps, and they have a corner wedged out on the floor where the media sits. So it's not up in the press box.
Right.
But it's this little triangular space. It's a great seat. I mean, it's really nice. So I sit down with my popcorn and beer. And all I'm looking at is rows of laptops and sour-faced white guys.
Wait, hold on.
Who need to buy their underwear.
Wait.
I swear to God.
Do you legit sit press row with popcorn and a beer?
I did this one time. And then I'm looking down to the left, down to the right, and going, you guys, these are great seats. Enjoy it. And then I thought, you can't. You're the working media. You know, like brain surgeons play nice music when they do surgery. Right. But oh no, a sports reporter, he's on assignment. He couldn't have popcorn.
And Carm, you can't argue that because I had the pleasure of sitting next to the biggest Cub fan there is, and Mark Carman, throughout the World Series and the playoffs, and Carman has no shame. He does not care if he is cheering with his brothers in Cubby Blue. Carmen is cheering.
In the press box?
Well, we've sort of had certain situations. So much the stiff press box. We were sort of – they have sort of makeshift press boxes, satellite, you know, to the overflow. So you're sort of outdoors, and it's a little bit different than the stuffy press box that you're used to. But Carmen, Carmen's a Cub fan.
We were deep in the right field corner in Cleveland, John, and when Dexter Fowler led off Game 7 with a home run, I
I got escorted out of the building.
Well, I accosted Kevin. And
the Philadelphia Eagles Media Relations Department showed up at the World Series and escorted Mark Carbonaro.
That's how bad it was. Well, I know if I spill my popcorn, you can't get mustard on your keyboard. I only did it once or twice. And then now when I go to the games, I can sit there. But I think I use my media pass to get there. And then I just go look for a free seat. And I have my beer over there because those guys are no fun to sit with.
But by the way, just to make this relevant to people not in the media, the conversation around this is like, are you comfortable with the media being biased? Because there's this whole thing, you can't be biased, you're in the media, you have to be objective. Like, no, we all have our biases, we all have our rooting interests, and there's a million different reasons.
But as long as those biases are put aside when your body of work is put out, whether that's writing or whether that's broadcasting, but during a game, deep down inside, everybody's going to feel a certain way.
Well, is there anybody that covers the Cubs who is not wanting the Cubs to win from
Chicago? That's right, and it's good for business, for no matter what you're doing, whether you're writing a newspaper column or whether you're talking about it on the radio. If the Cubs are winning, if the Bears are winning, that's good for everybody.
Absolutely. Whenever we would have Gordon Wittenmeyer on from the Chicago Sun-Times, I would introduce him as Sun-Times writer who hates the Cubs, Gordon Wittenmeyer. And he would deny that. But there was a lot. He had an agenda on what he was writing for a while, and I think it looked better for him if they were losing.